Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. Over the last 20 years, the world's most advanced militaries have invited a small number of military legal professionals into the heart of their targeting operations, spaces which had previously been exclusively for generals and commanders. These professionals, trained and hired to give legal advice on an array of military operations, have become known as war lawyers. In War Lawyers, the United States, Israel, and Juridical Warfare, published by Oxford University Press in 2021, Craig Jones examines the laws of war as applied by military lawyers to aerial targeting operations carried out by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Israeli military in Gaza. This book shows just how important law and military lawyers have become in the conduct of contemporary warfare and how it is understood. Craig Jones is a lecturer in political geography in the School of Geography, Sociology, and Politics at Newcastle University. I'm so glad his new book has brought him to our program. Welcome, Craig.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's really nice to be with you.
Terrific. So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Yeah, so well, I'm an academic geographer through and through, I guess. I've got all my degrees are in geography, so I don't know anything different. And I did my PhD at the University of British Columbia, and this was a few years ago now, and I became interested just one morning after reading a newspaper in the conflict in Israel and Palestine, and began reading around it. So that's how I got interested in this topic, which we'll talk more about. And right now, I'm a lecturer in political geography, like you said, here in Newcastle, which is in the north of England. And yeah, happy to be here, and it's good to be with you. Thanks for reading the book.
Great. So to get started, who is Colonel Daniel Reisner, and how does he fit into your discussion of the law and warfare?
Okay, so yeah, so just to set the context, the book is, you know, about the involvement of military legal professionals in targeting operations. I'm talking about lethal targeting operations, operations that kill people most of the time. And I've done a series of interviews with military lawyers, and they give legal advice to commanders on who they can kill and who they can't kill under these scenarios, looking, as you've said, in Gaza, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Particularly, my interviews were with the Israeli and U.S. military. So Daniel Reisner was one of these lawyers. He's an Israeli military lawyer, and he happens to have been, at least from about the period 2000 to 2008-ish, one of the most important and senior military lawyers in the Israeli military. I use him as a hook in the opening to the book because he was involved in very high-level decision-making for the Israeli military. And he plays a crucial role in this story because it was him, along with some others in the Israeli military, who learned from the U.S. experience of employing legal advisors in targeting operations. And that's something that he wanted to bring to the Israeli military. The Israeli military wasn't doing that on his watch prior to 2000. The year 2000 is key in Israel-Palestine because of this historic rise of what's called the Second Intifada or Shake-Off, which is a Palestinian popular uprising against occupation. And he wanted to consult military lawyers, and he had read US history. He was a keen historian, and he learned that the military lawyers in the US had been doing this for a decade or so. And he brought that practice to the Israeli military. And so in the book, I document a sort of highly dramatized case where he's called in a to the military commander's headquarters, who can't make a decision on whether or not to try to strike a particular target. So they call upstairs and say, "Hey, Daniel Reisner, can you help us make the decision?" And so he's a lawyer in the book. He's a key decision maker. And ultimately, that's what the book's about. He plays a pretty crucial role.
Right, right. I'm thinking for listeners who might be familiar with the movie Eye in the Sky, the 2015 movie with Helen Mirren, it sort of describes a scene very much like the one you were just describing, where there's a bunch of military people in a room together deciding about whether or not they could or should attack a particular target with unmanned military airplane and shoot, you know, a rocket or something and kill some target. And then they bring in the lawyers to try to help them decide, you know, whether or not this is technically a legal action to take. And so the one thing to think about is what countries have these war lawyers?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, for listeners, once you're done listening to this podcast, do go watch the film Eye in the Sky. It's a good one and puts, you know, puts the dramatization on what the book's about. In terms of the, yeah, how many countries have this? Not many. The US has led the way historically in employing military lawyers in targeting operations. They've been around for a long time, military lawyers and the corps to which they belong, the unit to which they belong, boasted it's the oldest and largest law firm in America. But they haven't done the targeting operations really until the 1990s. Israel followed suit in the 2000s. The UK has been doing something similar, although not as extensively involved, partly because our military operations aren't as big here in the UK as our Israel's operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and similarly the US, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan and well, many other places, let's just put it that way. Other NATO states also have these military lawyers. So by and large, you know, without making too much of a generalization, it is mainly, you know, quote unquote, Western military powers. So NATO member states, and the US and Israel, who consult these military lawyers regularly. I don't know, and I haven't done research on, for example, whether Russia has these military lawyers, whether China has these military lawyers. One would assume from the extent of bombing in somewhere like Syria, for example, that Assad doesn't have these same military lawyers, or if he does, then they certainly have different interpretations of international law. And so this is certainly not a ubiquitous practice, but in terms of, you know, quote unquote, Western democratic liberal states, are increasingly employing this as a practice, something that I think we're going to be seeing more of, you know, as the years tick by.
Right. And your book focuses almost exclusively on the lawyers, the role of lawyers in the American and Israeli military. Why does it focus on those two countries in particular?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's a couple of ways of interpreting it or answering it. The narrow way is because, as I've mentioned, the US military was the first state power to begin employing these military lawyers in targeting operations. And Israel is the sort of second major power to begin doing that. So that's the narrow reason, because I became interested in, you know, what difference does it make to have a military lawyer give advice on a target or not? Does it make any difference? Are they a fig leaf? Do they change operations? You know, why do they even exist? It seemed like a bizarre idea to me when I first found out about it. And so the question then is, okay, well, who does this and what's the history? And those two states emerge as the sort of biggest players in that field. I think more broadly and sort of more conceptually in a way, I think what you're seeing with those two states specifically, the US and Israel, is certain interpretations of international law or obligations under international law that, if you like, push the envelope of international law, that push at the edge of what is permissible in international law. And they do that via legal interpretation, via these military lawyers. And in the post 9/11 era, I think you really see this come to the fore with sort of creative legal interpretation, is to put it one way. You know, there was all the stuff, obviously, in Guantanamo and the torture and that sort of stuff. There was also this rise of targeted killing, which is, you know, that scenario you referred to with unmanned aerial vehicles, also known as drones, which have been striking in the global borderlands in Yemen and Somalia and Iraq, Afghanistan, many other places. And so those two states have a specific form of warfare, a sort of, in some ways, an invisible form of warfare that is like a global extrajudicial killing, you know, whereby they're killing individual terrorists in many different parts of the world. And that requires a legal rationale for doing that. You can't just do that. You know, you can't just make this stuff up and go kill people the other side of the world. You need lawyers in order to do that. And the states that are leading the way in that, in my opinion, I think, and the empirical evidence shows that the US and Israel are doing that far more, far better, or far worse, depending on your view, than anyone else.
Right. And you sort of touched on this already, but to help us understand this a little more, if you could expand on it a little bit, this issue of what really is the role of the war lawyer, specifically, does the involvement of war lawyers actually make the decisions regarding legal targeting operations any more, you know, humane, in quotes, you know, or limited in some way, or does it simply place a veneer of legality on what is actually morally unjustifiable? And just to put a fine point on the question, you mentioned just now that these operations are, quote, invisible. But the irony, of course, is that they're never invisible to their targets, right? I mean, they're invisible maybe until they get hit. But, you know, once a rocket or something is sent through someone's window and a building explodes and kills a bunch of people, all the people living there are perfectly aware of the action that has been taken, right? That they may not know necessarily definitively who the you know, who sent the rocket, you know, who is the perpetrator of this act, but they're perfectly aware of what happened to the building, you know. So I think it raises the question of just, in other words, what I'm trying to get at is, like, who are we really, like, even just to expand to go out a drop more and think about the idea of, like, top secret, something, these operations are highly secretive, whatever. But of course, who are they top secret from? You know, they're top secret certainly from the population of the country whose military is carrying out these operations. But they're not top secret from the targets who are impacted by these operations. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm a geographer, so this would be a crucial reading for me. I think that much of global politics, much of global war at the moment, you know, if we're going to get meta about it, is marked by this, what you're saying, this geographical separation of where violence takes place. Obvious case, you know, obvious historical cases. When was the last time the US fought a war on its soil, you know, other than Pearl Harbor, other than, if you want to construe it as an act of war, 9/11? The fighting is always done elsewhere, which means that, you know, when things are top secret, when things are invisible, they are invisible to populations at home, domestic populations in the US that have become war weary, that are no longer interested in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the toll, because we can't win them, because it wasn't an easy victory, just like Vietnam. And we've grown weary of it. And so it's sort of invisibilized to those populations. But like you say, it's daily talk in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, in places like federally administered tribal areas in northwest Pakistan, in Yemen. This is daily, you know, daily political problems that people keep on getting blown up from the sky. So there is, you know, what I would call, you know, a political geography here to the violence, right? Which is, I think you're absolutely right. That's one part of your question. There was another part. Should we come to that as well?
Sure, please.
So the other part, I guess, was about, you know, what difference do they make? First thing I want to say about that is these military lawyers, formally speaking, if you go read the texts, if you talk to them, they will say, we are not decision makers. It is not within their power. It is not within their professional guidance to make a decision. They are not the ones that say, yes, let's drop the missile. No, let's not drop the missile. That, formally speaking, is a power that resides with a military commander, with a decision maker within the military. That's formally speaking. That's like this, you know, like in the US, it's the separation of power. It's this ideal, ideal which is very difficult to live up to in practice. And I suppose the problem is, and what the book tries to do, and here it's a tension rather than something I want to resolve, is to say that when, because of the special place that law plays in our society, in the way that we structure social life, and increasingly the way that we structure our own militaries, law has a very special place that makes legal advice, that makes the figure of the military lawyer very difficult to ignore or sideline, which is to say that a military commander gets lots of advice. He gets advice from his weaponeers, like how big is the bomb we should drop? He gets lots of advice from his intelligence, like where to drop the bomb. He gets lots of advice from PR people, like, hey, if we drop this bomb, you know, it's going to blow up on CNN or the BBC. He gets lots of different advice. My argument in the book is that the lawyer's advice, because of law is special, in a problematic way, right? Because law is special, that advice blurs the line between who is the decision maker and who is the advisor, which is to say that legal advice is not just advice. It's not like, hey, I would encourage my child not to eat that second piece of chocolate cake. You know, it is advice that comes with a certain power that one can't freely ignore, which is not to say that every commander follows every piece of advice. It is to say that it comes with a special power, and partly the problem with that special power is the fact that I think it can do almost what you suggested there. It can absolve the moral conscience of the actor because they're told what they're doing is right by an authoritative figure, by a lawyer. And I think that's problematic.
Right, right. It's interesting. It's almost as if the way you were describing the status of law in quote-unquote, you know, Western countries, Western you know, enlightenment influenced, you know, countries, whatever. It's almost like the role that religion has had in prior eras in Western history, and also continuing today in various societies, where if something is given the patina of a religious belief or religious doctrine, it's considered to be somehow more more appropriate to listen to that that guidance than some other kinds of information.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think what these lawyers talk about, really interestingly, and since I published the book, there's been a couple of really interesting accounts that came out about this, which are really that, in the book I talk a little bit at the end, in the final chapters, about military lawyers as a kind of chaplain, and that military commanders go to these military lawyers, yeah, for advice, for strategic or practical everyday advice. But one lawyer, or a few lawyers, actually talked about themselves as giving absolution, right, this moral, religious absolution, for want of a better term, for the sins of military violence, right? I'm going to kill people. I might kill innocent women and children and men. And it's a difficult thing psychologically, religiously, spiritually to come to terms with. And the military lawyers, whether the commanders feel like they see them as that or whether they become that, they're certainly not formally that, but they're playing more than a legal role that is actually now, I think, sort of quasi-spiritual, I don't know what to call it, quasi-religious, where they're playing this role of absolution. You know, absolution comes from, I think, I don't know my religion, but, you know, comes from the Catholic Church of, you know, giving absolution for the sins in one's life. One goes to repent the sins and is given absolution. That's a worrying development. It's a worrying development that blurs lines between law, ethics, morality, and religion in ways in which, you know, once you elevate human-made law to the divine, I think you've got a serious problem on your hands.
Right, right. But it's interesting, again, if you think about, you know, how we're supposedly in the Western countries living in a secular age, and you think about the role of the lawyers in the military context, how they might be fulfilling or replacing what in former times may have been a gap that may have been filled by religious functionaries, where religious functionaries would say, yes, this is a just war. They would tell, you know, European monarch or something, this is a just war, sure, go ahead, cross the border, kill those other people, God wants it, you know? And now you have lawyers in a secular age coming along with, legal clauses or whatever, saying, yes, you're permitted to go ahead and do this thing, even though it may appear to you and certainly to other people as, you know, a truly heinous thing to do.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I know. The broad point here is that, you know, it's not just about these figures of the military lawyers. It's not like, oh, they're overstepping their mark, or they are doing something they shouldn't do, or they're looking for to just give absolution to make people feel better. My problem, you know, the title of the book is The War Lawyers. It's about a profession and people. The wider problem is that international law allows them to say and do the things that they say and do on a daily basis. And you know, it's that sort of permissive power. And they are, in some ways, just the vehicles for that sort of broader permissive power. And I think you're right, that when you get that blurring, they do fulfill that certain function. What it also does, which is slightly different from the religious or sort of spiritual element, in our, you know, secular liberal societies, it's not okay to say that one has a governmental procedure which is relying on some sort of divine will. And in place of that, you get law, and law as a lie, as law as providing objective answers to serious political or moral questions that, you know, whereby it's less subjective to ask a lawyer because there's process and protocol. So you have this whole apparatus. Targeting is a technological bureaucratic mechanism which divides a complicated business of killing people into bureaucratic individual tasks. And the lawyers really sort of help that. They help cover that complicated business, that moral and political business, in a proceduralism, and maybe there's proceduralism to religion too, but it's this displacement to procedure, to seemingly objective standards of, you know, something like due process and proportionality and necessity. By the way, due process doesn't exist in this sphere. That's that's a way too high a threshold.
Yeah, by the way, there's definitely proceduralism in religious context. I study sociology of religion. But anyway, we'll move off of the religious angle for now. I'm curious, we're talking about law, and there are these lawyers, and there's lawyers in different countries that are fulfilling similar functions. What law, concretely speaking, what law are they interpreting and analyzing in order to come up with these determinations?
Yeah, great question. It's not necessarily easy and straightforward, and sometimes it changes, but the simple answer to the question is that these lawyers are dealing with a sphere of law that has two names. One is international humanitarian law, IHL, and the other one is laws of armed conflict, or sometimes called LOAC, or LOAC. Essentially, that that's just literally two bodies of law, two names of the same body. You can also shorthand it to the laws of war. So this is a body of law that is often associated with the Geneva Conventions, sometimes also with the Hague Conventions. It is the international law that guides or that governs human activities when we go to war. It's different from the right to go to war in the first place, which is all about the UN Charter and the right of self-defense and those sorts of things that came out of World War II. This is a much older legal paradigm about humanitarian law, which is, okay, once humans go to war with each other, what rules should we agree upon to govern the conduct? You know, classic ones are like prisoners of war. We shouldn't torture prisoners of war. We should give them conditions. Other ones are certain protections of civilians. Others are care for the wounded and sick. So that's the key body of law, essentially the laws of war. Also gets mixed in sometimes with domestic law. So US domestic law gets mixed in, Israeli domestic law gets mixed in. National courts interpret some of this stuff that then feeds into military policy. So famously, the Israeli Supreme Court weighs in on a lot of this stuff on, for example, targeted killing. And then also you've got military law on top of that. So there's three different layers, right away from the international, domestic, and then what's called the rules of engagement, which are sort of specific military rules, which are like what soldiers can do, when they can fire, what rules do they have to follow. So it's a whole set of laws, really, but probably the most important is this international humanitarian law one.
Right. And speaking of the law, you make a point to say that the law is indeterminate. What do you mean by that?
So, yeah, my thing is, this might be a bit whack for some listeners, but my sense is that, you know, the law is a human-made phenomenon, and it doesn't have any exterior reality over the interpretations or our individual interpretations or judges' interpretations of it. So my sense is that when military lawyers come in to a targeting room and want to make a decision about the legality of something, the law is not, you know, it's not there in a book. It's not there on a page waiting to be found as some objective truth. In order to say, hey, yes, this is illegal, or no, it's not illegal, one has to do a lot of interpretive work, which is nothing to do with interpreting the law. You can't just read the Geneva Conventions and get a simple yes, no answer. You, as listeners on the other end of the this, you know, might have a very different interpretation of, hey, there's a scenario, can we kill these, you know, Hamas militants? Yes or no. There could be 100 different interpretations of that. Those interpretations require interpretations of everyday realities that have got nothing to do with law, such as what is the value of the target? What is the risk of the civilians next door? How much do we value the life of a school child next door who might be killed? How much, you know, collateral damage is there going to be by way of buildings and schools? What kind of missiles do we have? Why don't we have a better missile that's more precise? Those things have got, in my mind, absolutely nothing to do with the law per se. And yet those concrete realities from sort of everyday life, boring stuff, you know, what's the building made out of? Is it wood? Is it going to burn or is it going to fall? And not legal questions. And yet they weigh so heavily on legal calculations in such a way that, you know, going back to my scenario, it's not just a case of yes or no, but you need to interpret the world and you're going to get very different answers to that question. So my sense is that law, and you know, that this is a very practical example, but more philosophically, law has ambiguities which require interpretation. That law has actually no meaning until it's interpreted.
Right, right. And historically speaking, when did war lawyers begin shaping U.S. military doctrine?
Oh, hey, that's a great question. So they've been around, like I said, for a long time, for a few centuries. My sense is that, you know, I read this account in the Second World War, whereby these military lawyers were saying, hey, you know, we felt bad because we were so far away from the actual real soldiers that we didn't really do anything. So I think we can say pretty emphatically that in terms of U.S. military doctrine, they were more or less irrelevant in terms of strategic stuff until at least, you know, the Second World War. Where I really pinpoint in the book as being a pivotal moment is after the Vietnam War, less so during the Vietnam War. Military lawyers went to Vietnam, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s. U.S. military lawyers went to Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s, but they weren't involved in targeting at all. In fact, they were really far away. But a couple of things happened in Vietnam. One was some war crimes that were committed in 1968 that are known as My Lai or My Lai, depending on how you pronounce it. American soldiers went into a village and essentially committed war crimes, killing about 300 or 400 civilians. And it was a wake-up call for the U.S. military that it had such a strategic cost for them in the wake of it. You know, these war crimes allegations fed into the protest movement back in the United States, the anti-war movement, the famous 1968 protests, that war crimes have such a sort of strategic cost that actually lawyers, if they brief soldiers on the Geneva Convention, on the rules of law, maybe they won't commit such egregious crimes. And so then it's they emerge on the scene doctrinally and you know, alongside stuff that's happening internationally with what's known as the additional protocols of the Geneva Conventions, another set of laws that come across in the 1977 period. You know, the US military realizes the strategic value of sort of avoiding disaster with these military lawyers. So has them come in, first do small things like train in the instruction of the laws of war. Just teach soldiers, hey, this is the law, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do. And then as they become, more and more useful across the 1970s and 1980s, the argument is in the book is that's a crucial turning point, but that actually it's really in the post 9/11 era, you know, after the terror attacks of 9/11 in 2001, that they become crucial in determining, who lives and who dies, the direction of policy and what happens really in war.
Right. And when did war lawyers in Israel begin playing a significant role?
So they began in 2000, which coincided with what I mentioned before, the start of the Palestinian Second Intifada. And the case in Israel is interesting. There's a whole history of military legal advice in Israel as well. Military lawyers have been around in Israel for, you know, actually before the founding of the Israeli state in 1948. They had legal services to the Haganah, which is a sort of predecessor group of the Israeli state. And they've been around, but similar story. They didn't really do targeting. And it wasn't until this Daniel Reisner figure that I document in the book realizes that there's an unrealized potential here. And he comes on the scene in 2000. I suppose what I should also say is that the US military, the Israeli military for much of the second half of the 20th century is targeting and is killing Palestinians, but is not claiming a legal right to do so. So there's the famous cases is the Munich, after the Munich bombing assassinations, where the Israeli state goes after, captures or kills those that were responsible for the Munich bombings. Forget the exact date, but they don't ever. That's done covertly. It's never done with a legal right to say, "Hey, we have the legal right to target or kill or assassinate." That changes in 2000 with Daniel Reisner and with the Intifada, because what they want to argue is that with the Second Intifada, a threshold of violence is crossed, whereby Palestinians have become so violent that they need new legal procedures, that need war powers. They want to activate this international humanitarian law, get lawyers in, and essentially start, you know, targeting and killing Palestinians with a legal right and with some sort of legal process.
Right. And to go back to the American context, what role did the interpretation by U.S. lawyers of Iraq's infrastructure as, quote, dual use play in the U.S. attack on that infrastructure in the first Gulf War in the early 1990s?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, dual use and the first Gulf War is a whole thing that I think has been largely unexplored. So what we mean by dual use is it's a military term. It's also, a quasi-legal term, which says that if a place, building, object or thing is being used not only for a civilian purpose, but for a military purpose, it's therefore serving a dual use. So one key thing would be electricity production facilities or oil production facilities, whereby, you know, a nation like Iraq is using electricity for its civilian population, for, you know, to turn on fridges, to keep the lights on at home. The argument in Iraq in the 1990s was that Saddam Hussein had converted much of Iraq's civilian infrastructure, the electricity, the oil, into military uses, you know, was feeding it to, you know, oil was going to the tanks. And other sort of more complicated uses of this. And the legal reading there by the US military, and I don't necessarily think it's wrong, it is problematic, is that because they're using those infrastructures for military purposes under international law, they can therefore be targeted, even if they also still contain civilian objects or civilian people. And so what you do is you start bombing the infrastructure. You say it's dual use. And then, I mean, what happened in Iraq in 1990 and 1991 is that you, you know, you bomb a population so thoroughly on this basis that you reduce its capacity to produce electricity for itself, to sustain itself. And really you, you know, what I argue in the book is that it represents something like the total war doctrine of the Second World War, whereby it was a strategic objective rather than an accident to bomb a whole population, partly because it was called morale bombing or total bombing, because you want to bomb people so much that they pressure their own government to concede and sort of give up the war effort. I think actually something like that happened in Iraq in the 1990s, partly under this pretext of dual use.
Could you give us a sense of just how extensive and impactful the U.S. bombing of Iraq in the early 1990s was?
Yeah, it, I mean, it's difficult to communicate how impactful it was. We are talking, I mean, so the immediate bombing lasted just 40 days or 41 days, I think it was, killed around 3,000, 3,500 Iraqis immediately as a result of the bombing. However, epidemiologists went back and people studied the death toll in the long run because of all the secondary and tertiary effects of the bombing. You know, people didn't have access to water. People didn't have access to refrigeration. There was more increases in cases of cholera. People died of cold. All this stuff that was a result of the bombing but wasn't a direct cause, you know, today, tomorrow. And estimated that way in excess of 100,000. Even as much as 200,000 people had died as a result of the bombing. You have to bear in mind that what happened in the 1990s was a huge bombing campaign that followed immediately by United Nations and global sanctions on Iraq so that they could not then rebuild the infrastructures which had been destroyed. That was a deliberate political strategy. It's a strategy which is often framed as non-violent. You know, to just put sanctions on someone is better than bombing them. However, when you've already destroyed the infrastructure, then they can't rebuild it. That is obviously, you know, you have a huge impact. I think actually, you know, we see something like that, I would argue, in Gaza today. And, you know, that's a huge devastating impact. And, you know, the infrastructure in some ways, because we reinvaded and bombed Iraq again in 2003, they've been involved in a protracted civil war or transnational war ever since. Rise of ISIS, power vacuum. You know, is still actually recovering from the 1991 bombing because it hasn't been allowed to recover.
Right. And speaking of Gaza, how does Israel's aerial bombardment of Gaza fit into the larger picture of how Israel deals with the Palestinian population in its midst?
Oh, another great and difficult question. I think Gaza is in some senses a crucial part of the question of Palestine in the contemporary period. And in other ways, it's a territory that's set apart, actually, I think, deliberately as a tactic of or an Israeli strategy to separate the territories, the West Bank, from Gaza. I mean, some people talk about Gaza as a laboratory for, you know, Israeli military experiments, about Israeli military technologies. And I think that there's some truth to that. I think ultimately what the situation in Gaza, what you're seeing is intermittent periods of mass aerial bombardment, followed by, you know, a permanent siege, followed by also a sort of regimes of occupation, which do much the same as what's happened in Iraq, although it's still, you know, actively under siege, of course. So imports are not allowed. Certain goods are banned from entering. Exports are difficult. The movement of people across borders is difficult. You know, the new project that I'm doing looks at access to healthcare for those been traumatically wounded in Gaza. And for example, you know, if you're shot or if you've got a bomb wound that's complicated, there's not enough healthcare infrastructures in Gaza to care for that. And then Israel won't always let them out to cross borders in order to access their healthcare. So I think Gaza is in some ways the most extreme form of Israeli policy on the question of Palestine. And well, there's more I could say about it, but I'll leave it there, I think.
Right. And you talk about the difference between deliberate and dynamic targeting. What is the difference and how does this relate to war lawyers?
Yeah, okay. So deliberate and dynamic targeting is basically one. So deliberate is planned targeting. So it's where you know you've got a target in advance and you know you want to strike it. Let's say it might be a building, it might be a bridge or a weapons depot where you've got some intelligence in advance, you know, and then a few weeks down the line or a few days down the line, you want to target that. And then the dynamic target is one where, you know, when the pilot takes off on his or her flight, you don't necessarily know what they're going to target. Maybe something emerges during a battle, like you see a, you know, a quote unquote terrorist emerge from a building, get in his or her car and drive down the street. That would be a dynamic target because it emerges in real time. So the difference there is just about, you know, is it planned? Is there a planned component to it or is it live? Often military operations these days blur the two. You know, increasingly what happens in both Gaza and major theaters of war such as Iraq and Syria as well, you know, with regards to Russia, is that in the first days and weeks, actually Israel's done this for some time and is really good at doing it all the way back into the 1967 war. You take out the key strategic sites, the airports, the key infrastructures, the major military infrastructures, the planned targets in the first few days of the operation to render the enemy sort of weak. And then in the follow-up period, you then react to what the enemy does and you follow up with these dynamic strikes. Obviously, as you can imagine with the lawyers, it's like a pretty difficult situation because the live stuff happens around the clock. So you need 24/7 legal advice. It happens quickly. So you get commanders that, you know, get upset or that need to make a decision right now. Lawyers want more detail. They want more, you know, fidelity of information, more time, and they don't have time. And so that obviously presents a pretty serious situation for how do you give legal advice to someone who requires an answer in like 10 seconds or 1 minute.
Right. That's really interesting. And I mean, I think it challenges the very idea of a deliberative legal process. If you need it, the answers immediately, you know, is that really a kind of deliberative legal process or some other creature?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, right, is that we come to associate law and, you know, whether that's because we're watching TV and we're watching these prolonged or protracted legal trials as a deliberative process, it's something that takes time. You know, if you've ever done jury service, it takes a long time to even, you know, be a juror on a jury. Things take time. Law is notoriously small for victims. You know, the legal procedure is drawn out, often annoyingly so. Here we have something like the opposite case where, you know, it's seconds and minutes. There's no time for a judge to come in, look at balance of evidence. Certainly there's not a sort of prosecution. There's no defense. So that whole sort of criminal paradigm that we might, you know, automatically think of when we think about legal procedure just doesn't apply. It's such a different procedure. And not therefore saying it's not law or it's not right, or we should have that criminal paradigm because then, you know, well, no war is going to get done if that's the case. I mean, you know, I'm absolutely pro that, but that's a whole other story. So I'm not saying that it's realistic to have that, but it is at least to say that it's problematic. And I think that's what's difficult because when we impute such power to law and the legal word, almost imply that it's some sort of magical force. And then we look at actually how sort of arbitrary and quick and you know, it might be in one case that I've read about recently since the book was published, legal advice was a table tennis bat in a guy's hand in the operation room and with one side red and one side green. And, you know, he needed to turn it over. And when it went green, that was yes. I mean, if that's what legal process and procedures come to, again, that's not a criticism of that process, but we're reducing huge, huge, huge problems about law, morality, killing other people, you know, because the table tennis bat goes up and it's green.
Right, definitely. And it's interesting to think, like you mentioned in the start of our conversation, that the law has a particular, almost revered status in Western society and culture. And it's interesting to think about, you know, how it got that status and to what extent is that status dependent on people's sense that the law is a quote unquote objective in some way, but also deliberative and thoughtful and analytical. And it's because of these qualities or the assumption that these qualities exist in the law that possibly the law has the kind of very high status that it does in Western societies. And that if this kind of legal processes where people are making split second decisions and signaling it by the flip of a paddle, that maybe this will erode or corrupt the very status of law in these societies.
I think that's right. I mean, I can't answer the question of, you know, where it's come from. It's obviously a very historical contingent thing. I suppose, you know, we can look to it through completely other examples that have nothing to do, you know, with my book or this discussion, such as the role, for example, of law in the resolution of sexual violence or sexual assault with, for example, the Me Too movement, whereby victims of sexual assault have become so thoroughly disillusioned with the legal process because it systematically failed them. I mean, arguably systematically failed them in the US case, right up to the Supreme Court, because we have a potential, sexual assailant in the Supreme Court.
Possibly more than one.
Possibly more than one. Well, okay.
Documented more than one.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
at least two.
Right. Well, there we go. In the highest power. And, So what happens then to that law and legal system when it fails to function for those who it's designed to protect? They lose faith in it. And then we talk about the law as something which is no longer useful to particularly vulnerable communities. And therefore, you know, we go to other languages. We go towards social justice, or we take to the streets. We find Me Too as a movement, as a social movement that has sometimes a language of law. Harvey Weinstein and whatnot go through a court and legal process. Some do, some don't, but there's much extra legal work to be done, I suppose. And so, I don't know, you transfer that back to law or to military context, and I'm not sure. I mean, in some ways, obviously, I'm pretty cynical about what's happened to the process of law in military spaces, so much so that I don't think it serves the people who it should serve. I guess is a wider question of whether the law, the international law, was designed to ever serve the victims of military violence, not its perpetrators, which is probably where I'd stand on the issue.
Right. I mean, I think your book, I think our discussion of your book just highlights how fascinating your book is and how complex the issues it grapples with. We could, you know, talk for endlessly about all sorts of related topics. And I think it is interesting to think about sort of why the law and war lawyers were introduced into the military, as you said, because of the status of the law in these societies, and how potentially the very process of incorporating lawyers in such a formalized and bureaucratized a procedural way could actually diminish the status of law, thus making it useless to have lawyers in the military serving this function.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I want to, you know, say something here that that sometimes goes against my own political position, but military lawyers and militaries aren't the only ones that have sort of, you know, brought law into disrepute in this regard. So, I mean, anytime civilians are killed in modern war, we see this almost daily in global news, in the various contexts that our listeners are listening to. And as some civilians die, almost invariably, various different constituents from the international community, sometimes the UN, often, you know, human rights organizations and human rights people on Twitter and in media will say it's a war crime. Civilians were killed, it is a war crime. That is an incorrect legal formulation most of the time, because it's not a crime to kill civilians. It's a crime to kill civilians in certain ways, and so what the military's get frustrated with is this sort of misusing of the law to say, you know, like to hold militaries to a higher threshold to say that, like, even if you kill one civilian, now we're going to accuse you of a war crime. I think that's an incorrect legal procedure, an incorrect legal reading. But what they're doing when they do that, when Human Rights Watch do that, when Amnesty International do that, you know, I'm broadly sympathetic, but they are misrepresenting law for what it says. But two, and more importantly, they are resorting to the very language of law that the military uses and that the military can come back with and say, well, hang on a minute. It says here that, you know, as long as you take into account X, Y, and Z, you can kill civilians. So it's just the wrong language to use, and it results in a sort of mutual erosion from the military side and from the humanitarian side. And this is, you know, we don't have to get into it, but this is what's now called lawfare, the use of law as a weapon of war. Law has just become irredeemably strategic. If you don't like what someone's doing, just call them a war criminal, say they've killed civilians. And you know, for the most part, publics don't really understand the nuances of law. So what counts as law is what gets counted or what gets said as a war criminal. That's the poverty of international law, and it's a sort of, you know, it's, I don't think it's a useful discussion.
Right. I think that, again, this brings out that, like you said, when whether it's Amnesty International or certainly many political activists, people who are concerned about social justice, when they take to the streets or when they clamor against a particular military action and say that it's illegal or if this goes against the law, what they really mean is that it's unjust, that the way that they understand the world, the way that they understand morality about justice, they feel that this action violates basic concepts of justice and of morality. And they associate justice and morality with formal legal procedures. But what you're saying, and I think I also agree with this, I think that association itself may be faulty, that when we think about the law, especially when it pertains to military actions and warfare, the law may not necessarily or certainly may not intrinsically be moral or just. It's simply a set of guidelines to execute warfare. And if you follow those guidelines, then you're technically following the law. I mean, there's a meme on Facebook that goes around a lot that highlights this point. And it says that, you know, the Nazis, that when the Nazis killed Jews, they were within the bounds of the law. And when Germans or others tried to resist this genocide, they were acting illegally. And the same thing with the mistreatment of Black people in the American American history and during the Jim Crow era, where those who were mistreating or denigrating Black people were following the law. And those who were fighting against that mistreatment were actually breaking the law. So it just highlights that the law is not necessarily intrinsically just or moral.
Yeah, I mean, I think at best, depending on what spheres or areas of political life we're looking at, law has at best a tangential relationship to justice and morality. I think in the case of, you know, these war lawyers, things, it was never even conceived of as trying to be about something like justice or something like what we often associate with law. I mean, by and large, it was first conceived of as a way of protecting soldiers, you know, protecting them when they got wounded and sick. And then it became a strategic calculation about, you know, protecting civilians in war. It wasn't really about justice. Even the protecting civilians in war had a strategic element. It doesn't make any sense to kill civilians in war. It wasn't necessarily, oh, because it's nice and fluffy and justice to not kill civilians. It had a counterproductive effect. You know, you kill civilians like you do in Vietnam and the population turns against you. That happens the world over. The history of warfare is that actually it's, you know, a strategic cost. So, yeah, these things that, you know, I mean, again, depends on what sphere we're talking about. My book is fairly cynical of the role that law plays in particular ways, but that's because it's been taken up in particular ways by particular institutes or powers. I think law can be, a hugely powerful force for good. Much work has been done, certainly in the 20th century. I'm thinking particularly of the civil rights movement, the human rights movement more broadly. Not that those movements don't come without costs to advance causes, particularly of marginalized people. So I wouldn't be willing to throw the whole law out or whole of international law out. But certainly, along with others, people like Samuel Moyner, a Yale historian, are talking about this at the moment. We really need to examine the costs of what happens when we talk about things in a legal register.
Right. Well, as you said, there's so much more to discuss about this topic, but we'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and hope listeners enjoy it too.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.